Radio News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It could have been worse, is the phrase we're hearing from a lot of emergency officials this morning in the Granite State after Superstorm Sandy's arrival yesterday. But even though it wasn't as devastating as feared, there were impacts. At one point, more than 200,000 New Hampshire homes were without power. Now that number's roughly 175,000. Some roads in the lower half of the state are still closed due to downed trees or power lines. Hundreds of schools are also closed, many of them giving kids and teachers a second day off. But overall, Granite Staters are breathing sighs of relief today as the storm heads northwest. They're also keeping in touch with loved ones living further down the East Coast as the news from New York, New Jersey, Delaware, and Maryland looks much more serious. Today in The Exchange, a day after Superstorm Sandy hit, we'll assess its impact in the Granite State and the region. Let's hear from you, too. How did the storm affect you and your community? What are you hearing from friends and relatives in other areas where the weather was much more severe? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. With us for the hour is NHPR reporter Sam Evans-Brown. He's been following the storm yesterday and today. Sam, I know you've been busy. Thanks for being here.
Not at all, Laura.
And joining us now on the phone is Jim Van Dongen. He's Public Information Officer for the New Hampshire Office of Emergency Management. Jim, I know you've got limited time, too, so I appreciate you giving us a couple minutes.
Hey, good morning, Laura.
Well, give us the big picture, if you could, Jim, please. What impact has this storm had on New Hampshire?
Well, it's had, obviously, the major impact is power lines being down and also associated with that, a lot of roads blocked, again, because of power lines and trees being down, all because of the high winds that we saw yesterday. This is a moving target, obviously, but the last time I checked, which was within the hour, we had about 35 state roads that were closed in some portion and close to 200 local roads. And while there are a couple of places where there's high water, for the most, probably 99% has to do with downed trees and wires. The other remaining issue, besides power restoration, which could take till the end of the week or so, maybe more, is there's still some rain falling in the North Country, and there's still a possibility of flooding at some of the rivers and streams up there. So we really did manage to dodge the worst of this one, especially when you see the video footage from places like New Jersey. But we're not exactly out of the woods yet, so it's too soon to declare victory and go home.
So we're not out of the woods yet. You touched on it, but clarify on that a little bit. Do you mean flooding? Do you mean we got to wait till these roads are cleared? What do you mean, Jim?
Well, it's going to take some time and effort. It's very labor-intensive to clear these roads. It takes coordination between DOT and local public works crews, Sawyer crews to get in there and clear out trees so that the line crews can get in and restore the power. And that's going to be done, it's good. That's going to take time. As I said, it's very labor intensive. And then again, we may have some flooding issues up north. So those two issues are still not completely resolved.
And you mentioned up north, although most of the coverage I've seen, Jim, says that it was toughest for the bottom half of the state. Is that right?
As far as the wind goes, yes. The wind came up yesterday, sort of midday, pretty much on schedule. And the storm moved up from Massachusetts through New Hampshire. So it was the southern half of the state that got the wind, and the northern half on the end of that, so to speak, is getting the extra, getting a little more rain than we got here.
And Jim, a lot of people, and I'm sure yourself, are reflecting on what we've learned from past big storms with major outages, the ice storm of 08, of course, but also Snowtober of last year. What do you think at the state and local emergency level you all have learned about preparation for big events like this?
I think it's when I started this job about 100 years ago, I used to have to refer to storms like the hurricane of 38 or the floods of 36. And, that's a tough sell when you're trying to tell people about emergency preparedness. But since 2005, we've had a whole series of major disasters, some of which have affected large portions of the state, others are more regional. But starting with the Allstead flood in October of 2005, they've been a pretty regular occurrence. So I think people really do need to not think in terms of, well, this is something that happens elsewhere in the country. We do have disasters in New Hampshire and elsewhere in northern New England, some quite serious. And people do need to take a certain amount of responsibility for their own activities and to protect their families.
Well, and elaborate on that if you could. You know, you folks in emergency management can say, don't go out, don't do this, don't do that. But what about the general public? Have we gotten a little bit smarter about heeding those warnings?
I think so. And one of the, I was in a meeting this morning that Governor Lynch was leading with his department heads, and the general observation was after yesterday's meeting, the governor put out a statement saying, you know, we really would like people to stay off the roads in the afternoon. And as a matter of fact, traffic was pretty light in the afternoon. And that's a good thing because traffic, because it, driving was dangerous yesterday. I mean, the winds that are high winds like that, 35, 40 mile an hour, pretty consistent, plus gusts higher than that, makes debris fly around. There was water ponding on the roads. And, of course, there's always a possibility of encountering downed lines unexpectedly. So people do seem to heed the warnings, and while we don't want to see people just at the last minute go and clean out the stores of batteries and bottled water and stuff like that, it would be better to do that in advance. I think people kind of understand that it can happen here, it does happen here, and people need to be prepared.
So even though it looks fine outside your window, there may be a downed tree or a downed power line a mile away.
Sure, and you know, information is readily accessible, and that's true even if the power is out. A lot of people have handheld devices. Between broadcast news sources in particular and internet sources, you can find out what's going on. I mean, we're using Doppler radar, river gauges, and all this. These are open to everybody. These are not, this is not information that is closed to state officials or anything like that. If you want to find out what's going on or what's coming, it's the information is out there.
Well, and Jim, one last question. I know you've got a lot to do, and I know there's an announcement from Governor Lynch coming at 10 o'clock, so you're getting ready for that. Here's the flip side of what we just talked about, though. What do you think, Jim? Have we become overly cautious, for example? Lots of New Hampshire schools closed yesterday, and yet, you know, the storm really wasn't that severe until much later in the afternoon.
It, the people who can't win in a situation like this are the people like school superintendents who have to make decisions on whether they should close or dismiss early, because we don't have specific information. Storms don't arrive at the exact moment that we expect them to. So people who are in charge of those types of institutions generally err on the side of caution, and sometimes they can take backlash for that because there are costs associated with those decisions. But if you look at the flip side of it, what happens if you don't dismiss early or you don't cancel school? You get the kids there, and then the storm blows in, and you've got to get them home in the height of a raging storm. I mean, there's really no way to win in that situation.
All right, Jim, good to talk to you. Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
All right, Laura. Good morning. Bye-bye.
Jim Van Dong, and Public Information Officer for the New Hampshire Office of Emergency Management. The number for you to join us here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Sam Evans Brown is with us, too. He's a reporter here at NHPR who's been following, tracking our storm coverage. Sam, just real curious from you, what were the expectations going into this thing?
Well, Laura, I think the expectations were actually pretty extreme, mostly because of the history of the storm, because this time last year we had such an extreme weather event, the unprecedented snowtober that knocked out power to over 300,000 residents in New Hampshire. And so I think it was the echoes of snowtober that made, you know, this seem like it was going to be a repeat. This is going to be, you know, a fixture of October, some sort of crazy storm. And I think in the media especially, that created sort of an echo chamber effect. And so we really hyped this one up. But, you know, I think what we saw is that, you know, it was a little bit overhyped here.
All right. Well, and speaking of what happened and what didn't happen, Sam, I want to bring in Mary Stampone to our conversation. She's New Hampshire State Climatologist and an assistant professor of geology at UNH. Mary, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me.
What made this storm unusual, Mary, the whole Frankenstorm phenomenon?
Well, Frankenstorm was an interesting name for it, but what was unusual is that, you know, it was a tropical system that did come this far north this late in the season, which is unusual, and the fact that it did merge with another storm, a normal mid-latitude storm system that we would expect this time of year to create this very, very large sort of dual storm system that has impacted the entire Northeast and is continuing to impact as far west as the Great Lakes region.
And we were all watching those, you know, fun, shifting, changing maps yesterday. Did it travel, Mary, according to predictions in terms of the path it was expected to take? After Irene, we all learned that, you know, the path can be important, especially our friends in Vermont.
Yes, and it did seem to track fairly closely to what they were predicting 1 to 2 days or even 3 days out. It did hit the, southern New Jersey and move inland through the mid-Atlantic, which is pretty much where the path was for the few days leading up to the storm.
Well, and as Sam Evans-Brown pointed out, there was a lot of, you can call it hype, you can call it attention, concern here in New Hampshire that it would hit us really hard. Why do you think, Mary, it didn't hit the Granite State as hard as expected?
I mean, if you looked at the forecast produced by the National Weather Service as well as the National Hurricane Center, those forecasts were for, you know, lower precipitation amounts, the high winds, but we did get those winds. And so I don't think the forecasts were necessarily all that, extreme for what we actually saw. I think they were fairly close to the mark. But then, you know, when you have all of the coverage, again, it's more of the constant, you know, feed of this information that everybody, you know, kind of gets all wrapped up into it. And, you know, and the damages down south, they were not overhyped. That, you know, it was a very serious storm.
Sure, and we'll hear a little bit more later about New York and New Jersey. Again, as Sam pointed out, Mary, this storm did come on the anniversary of Snowtober, another wacky weather event. Are we looking at a new normal here, Mary, where these giant storms hit us more frequently?
I mean, you can't put any one particular storm or blame any climate change for any one particular storm. However, the weather setup has, you know, has made these storms more possible. And in the case of Hurricane Sandy, the fact that we had warmer ocean waters off the coast allowed this storm to move further up than what we probably would have expected with cooler ocean waters. And it also allowed it to get more of that fuel from evaporation that it needs to stay a tropical system this far north, this late in the season. And so that's, again, related to the overall increase in sea surface temperatures that we have observed over the past several decades. And so it's reasonable to think that, you know, these might be more frequent events in the future.
All right, Mary, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Mary Stampone, New Hampshire State Climatologist and Assistant Professor of Geology at UNH. We'll start taking your phone calls in just a couple minutes at 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and more of our update on Hurricane Sandy and its impact on the Granite State and the region on The Exchange on NHPR, and at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, a broader look at the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy. New Hampshire weather today, cloudy, scattered showers, gusty winds. Some showers could contain some heavy downpours, highs 63 to 68 degrees. Tonight, cloudy, breezy, a few showers possible, lows from 50 to 55. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, breezy, chance of showers, highs 61 to 66 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from the AHA Social Business Summit, a live and virtual social conference featuring speakers from HubSpot, Constant Contact, Dine, and Epiphanies, Inc. Registration at ahasummit.com. And from Child and Family Services, presenting Big Bad Voodoo Daddy in concert November 18th at the Lebanon Opera House for an evening of big band swing. Details at cfnh.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the impact of Superstorm Sandy on the Granite State and on the broader Northeast region. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. How did the storm affect your community? How did it affect you personally? And what are you hearing from friends and relatives who may live in other areas where the weather was much, much more severe? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. Sam Evans-Brown is with me, NHPR reporter, who's been providing our storm coverage here at New Hampshire Public Radio. And we're going to go now briefly to Vermont to talk to Ross Sneed. He's news director at Vermont Public Radio. Ross, thanks for giving us the time today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Good to be here, Laura.
Well, in Vermont, I was over there about a month or two ago. You're still recovering from Hurricane Irene. How were Vermonters feeling in advance of this storm?
Well, I have to tell you, there was a lot of angst over here because, as you say, there was a lot of damage from hurricane, or rather tropical storm Irene, about a year ago, 14 months ago. And so with this storm bearing down, there were a lot of people thinking, oh, no, not again. So there were a number of towns that activated their emergency operations centers kind of out of a newfound habit. They are now prepared for these storms, they think, in a better way. And from one end of the state to the other, there were people who were standing by ready to respond if necessary.
And in the end, though, how severe was it in Vermont?
It really wasn't bad. I've heard a lot of folks say, well, I've had wind storms worse than this. We had some fairly high winds along the ridge lines and along the western slopes of the Green Mountains and coming off the western slopes of the White Mountains in the northeast part of the state. But by and large, not too bad. At the height of the storm, there were somewhere around 20,000 people who lost power. That number has gone down quite a lot. And the last I looked, it was between 8,000 and 9,000 people without power.
Wow, that's not very much.
No, not at all. In fact, I think even the experts were surprised, frankly, breathing a sigh of relief. The way it was described to us by the weather experts is because Hurricane Sandy remained such a strong storm before landfall and was moving at a pretty good rate, it really decreased the amount of wind that came around from the northeast into Vermont, I presume into New Hampshire as well. And so we just never had the kind of sustained winds that we expected.
Yeah, so it looks like it hit New Hampshire a little bit worse this time. What are the expectations today, Ross, in terms of cleanup, going back to business as usual, kids back in school, and so forth?
Well, there are a number of schools that are closed today. They were closed in advance of the storm just out of fear of what would happen. A number of the colleges around the state also called off classes, at least for the morning. And state government is closed until 10 o'clock this morning. But that was all precautionary, and frankly, it is pretty close to back to business as normal at this point. A lot of kids have the day off. They're going to be enjoying what I see as sunshine outside right now. So a pretty good day for the school kids.
All right. Not so much for the parents who are working, but we'll leave that aside for the moment. Thanks a lot,
that's
Ross.
Exactly. Yes, yeah. You're welcome.
Thank you. That's Ross Snead again. He's news director at Vermont Public Radio, giving us an update on the impact in Vermont. And as we heard, Sam Evans-Brown, not so much in Vermont. I want to follow up on something, though, that Mary Stampone said, Sam. Not only have you been providing our storm coverage, but you're also our environment reporter here at NHPR. What have the scientists you talked to been saying about whether these big, weird storms are, in fact, the new normal?
So this, Laura, this gets into a sort of a complicated area of science called attribution science. It's whether or not you can attribute a random event to a broader effect such as climate change. And with hurricanes, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has said it has low confidence that you can attribute any hurricane effect to climate change. There's better linkage to extreme heat events and isolated, or you can say more general rain events. So an individual hurricane, it's very hard to say. There's so many factors going into a hurricane. It's very hard to say that a single one can be attributed to climate change. But I'd like also to talk a little bit about something that our correspondent over there in Vermont said, which is about this preparedness factor. And we heard from Jim Van Dongen that since 2005, we've had sort of constant weather events, and we're now much better prepared. And I think that we heard that from Governor Lynch. He said that over his tenure that we've really dialed up the degree of sort of preventative measures that they take before a storm. And you can also look at that as sort of a sign of the new normal, that now every state is much more concerned about how they're going to respond to these disasters, and they have a better plan because they've just had to do it more often.
And Governor Lynch declaring a state of emergency yesterday. This morning, Congressman Bass announced his strong support for Governor Lynch's request for a federal disaster declaration for all 10 counties in New Hampshire as a result of the hurricane. Sam, you may not know, but what sort of happens when governors ask for these federal declarations? The government doesn't always say yes. It kind of depends on conditions on the ground.
Right. It depends on the sort of dollar figures. It depends on how bad the situation is elsewhere. And I think it's sort of a case by case scenario. They take it as it comes. So with the disaster being much worse in many other states, I think it sort of weakens the New Hampshire request. So we'll see what they say, but it's up in the air.
Our number here in the exchange for you to join us with your questions, comments, and of course your experiences with Superstorm Sandy is 1-800-892-6477. Tell us what impact this storm had on you personally or friends and family further down the East Coast, where the weather was much worse, as we've been hearing all morning. The number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the exchange page at nhpr.org. We've been talking a lot about power outages, and joining us now on the phone is Mike Skelton, media contact for Public Service of New Hampshire. PSNH serves about 500,000 homes and businesses, or about 70% of the state. Mike, a busy morning. Thank you for being with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me, Laura.
Well, let's start off with that basic number everyone's wondering about. Mike, how many people or households were without power, and where are we at now with that?
Sure. Currently, as of this morning, we have about 125,000 customers without power. That's down from a peak of 137,000 customers last night. So we're making progress, but we've got a long road ahead. We're anticipating this is going to be a multi-day restoration effort. This storm delivered as promised in terms of power outages, and we're seeing a lot of damage. And certainly the fact that this storm is impacting the entire eastern seaboard adds a dynamic that provides an additional challenge for us here in New Hampshire.
And that additional dynamic or additional challenge is what, Mike?
Well, we have 6.5 million people without power up and down the eastern seaboard, and that is putting crew resources at an extreme premium. And so there's a competition out there to get as much resources as you can. We're working very hard to secure additional resources. We put a request out days before the actual storm arrived for additional crews to come here. We actually have 80 crews on the ground today from as far away as Texas.
Wow. And
so just to think that we have to go that far out of our region to bring crews in to help, I think speaks to the magnitude of this storm. So we're going to be continuing to work to bring more resources in because ultimately that's what helps get these outages solved faster.
Well, and what else have utilities learned, Mike, from past major weather events, especially, again, you know, Snowtober, the Halloween storm that was right around this time last year?
Well, absolutely. There's been a lot of lessons learned over the last few years. We've continued an aggressive tree trimming program, an enhanced tree trimming program to maintain our lines, because what we found with these storms, whether it's Hurricane Irene, Snowtober, this storm, tree outages are ultimately the root cause of a lot of what we see out there. It's tree limbs and trees coming down. However, given that New Hampshire is the most forested state in the country, we're never going to be able to prevent every outage just by trimming trees. The other preparation we can make is communication. We focus very much on how we can communicate to customers the most up-to-date information using social media, using news releases, being out there as much as we can. We also put community liaisons in the field and every community that's impacted so that local emergency contacts have a go-to person they can reach out to get up-to-date information.
Yeah, and I noticed that myself this time. At our house, we got a preparation call from the utility company. We got a get-prepared call from Comcast. I think that was a first, Mike, where we were getting these warnings at our house in advance that there could be trouble.
It is a change, and it's something we've added to, and we're going to continue to expand on. I think some people may think it's a little bit too much preparation, but we figure we can err on the side of doing too much rather than doing too little. And as many times as we can warn people, even if the storm isn't as significant as we think it could be or was, we want people to be prepared. And because ultimately, getting back to my point about it's impossible to prevent every outage when you have a significant and massive storm like this. The best thing customers can do is have a plan for themselves to be prepared, to think about how they're going to be able to take care of their family and friends and loved ones if they're without power for a day or two, to think about if they're going to be able to use a generator, how they can do it safely, to make sure they have supplies. I mean, that's ultimately the best way to ensure their comfort, knowing that we simply aren't going to be able to prevent every outage when you have a significant weather event like this.
Yeah, some of the warnings that we got said, hey, if you want more information to track outages and progress, go to this website or that website. And a lot of people could do that, but without power, a lot of people can't go to a website. So a little frustrating to be told to find out more, go to a website when you've got no power.
Yeah, we recognize that as well. But we found, though, is that so many of our customers are using smartphones now. All of those mediums that we're using online are mobile-friendly.
Sure.
And that people are able to log on from work or from their car, from their smartphone. They're finding a way to charge. So we recognize that. But that's, again, the other reason why we use the phone calls to home, knowing that some people may not be able to log online. They still have that landline so they can get a call.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Mike. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Mike Skelton, media contact for PSNH, again, the state's largest utility, telling us that about 125,000 PSNH customers are still without power. Well, as we've been saying, the impacts in New Hampshire were not as great as feared, but boy, down the East Coast in New Jersey, New York, Maryland, it was a lot worse. With us now in studio is Keith Shields, the executive producer of The Exchange. Born and raised in Northeast New Jersey, he's been in contact last night and this morning with lots of friends and family in that area. Keith, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, what are you hearing from folks back home? It was bad in New Jersey.
It was. I mean, I'm 43 years old. I don't think New Jersey has ever in my lifetime experienced such a storm. I mean, we had Gloria. I remember that growing up in high school, but nothing that did so much damage. You know, I do talk, as you said, to a lot of my friends, especially over Facebook, friends and family. One friend reported you could smell smoke and see smoke from transformers exploding all over the place.
Wow.
Another commented about the blues and the greens and the reds that were lighting up the sky as transformer after transformer blew up. Someone mentioned that you could hear sirens all over the place. You know, people in New York City, friends of mine who live in New York City, were commenting and taking pictures about flooding in the streets. Someone had mentioned the wind whipping down chimneys, making noises like a freight train, houses shaking. One of my friends in the Northeast actually had a tree uprooted and land on her kitchen. Skylights and windows were broken all over her kitchen. She had to kind of run to the center of her house. And, you know, the thing that really stuck out with me was one of the friends that I went to high school with. He's a fireman in my hometown. And he said, this is going to be bad and it's going to take years to recover.
Wow. It sounds like a Hollywood movie there, Keith.
It does.
I mean, jeepers.
The way they described it, really, that's a good way to explain it.
Well, so you gave us that update. Wow. From last night, pretty dramatic. What are people saying just this morning about how it's looking? Again, given that, you know, you may have some difficulty communicating with some people.
Well, yeah. And it's interesting. There's real pockets, you know, up in the Northeast, as I said, where I'm from, it's really bad. I mean, mostly everybody I talk to is without power, without heat. But friends of mine who have moved down to southwestern New Jersey by the Philly area, some of them actually never had their power lost the whole time. And I would say that's even closer to point central of the hurricane. But up in the Northeast, I mean, it's bad. You know, somebody a friend of mine who lives in the Jersey City area described it as a war zone this morning. One of my friends actually had her cupola blown off of her garage. And, you know, I think especially outside of the Northeast, the shore, you know, the Jersey Shore, I mean, it gets a kind of a bad rep in pop culture these days. But you got to understand where I'm from, Long Beach Island, Seaside Heights, Point Pleasant. I mean, this is the livelihood. This is where people escape the urban areas. This is where people have been going for decades upon decades to kind of get away from it. And, you know, from what the pictures are showing, places are underwater. It could take a long time to recover. One friend said it's just pure devastation down there, and just thinking about it makes her want to cry.
Right, because, and my husband's from New Jersey, as you know, and those coastal areas in New Jersey are beloved by New Jerseyites, if you can call us that, because it is so urban, and it's a great place to escape. And let's talk about that a little bit, Keith. How is responding to coping with this kind of extreme weather different for a tightly compacted, densely populated place like New Jersey versus someplace more rural and spread out like New Hampshire?
Yeah, you have to understand, Laura. I mean, I've sort of lived in both places now. I've lived in kind of rural New Hampshire and I lived in urban New Jersey. And, you know, where I'm from, it's just person upon person, house upon house, car upon car. It's so compact. And, you know, we've had our storms before, but the after effects, nothing like this. I mean, we're not used to being able to not come and go as we please, not go through tunnels because they're flooded, not being able to get on the subway when we want to, you know, not being able to leave your road because both sides of the street are blocked with big trees that have fallen down. So, you know, growing up, living here for about 9 years, I've sort of gotten used to the fact that, you know, every now and then there's going to be a tree blocking my road and I'm going to have to be patient about it. Or the power's going to go out maybe once a year for 3 or 4 days and I'm going to have to sort of make do with it. But not there. So, you know, reading between the lines with my friends, they have this deer caught in the headline feeling about themselves, about not knowing what to do, wanting to go out, being told not to go out, not knowing what to do without electricity. So it's very tough for them today.
Yeah, so they're not used to this whole emergency preparedness thing that it's kind of second nature to us here in New Hampshire at this point.
Right, exactly. You know, they're used to being able to at least go to the, you know, local Wawa or the local 7-Eleven the next day and get what they need if they have to.
What's a Wawa?
As a Wawa, it's like a 7-Eleven, but in the South.
Well, last thing, and again, super serious in New Jersey and New York. What are your friends, family, Keith, looking out for this morning, especially given that, okay, you look outside and it doesn't look too bad, but there could be some dangers there.
Well, friends talk about other people kind of venturing out and how that's not a smart thing to do and let the professionals take care of things and let the professionals cut down the trees and let the professionals, you know, put up the wires first before they go out. I think a lot of my friends are sort of trying to be as patient as possible. They're trying to make the best of it. They're, you know, kind of bonding over social media. They're trying to help each other out in any way, shape, or form, at least emotionally. But, you know, I think they've come to realize that this is going to take a long, long time to recover from. And I think that's just about settling in right now. So, you know, again, it's that deer caught in the headline feeling that I'm getting from a lot of them.
Right. All right, Keith. Well, thank you. Real interesting stuff. The stories are amazing.
Thank you, Laura.
All right. And Sam, super quick to you before we go to the break. Talk a little bit about this emergency preparedness mindset that we have in New Hampshire. If we could pat ourselves on the back a little bit here. I mean, we're kind of getting used to this stuff.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I think that perhaps one of the comments that Mike Skelton had made is really illustrative here, is that he said we're the most forested state. That's actually not 100% accurate. We're the most tree-covered state, not the most forested. That's somehow different. I have been chastised for this in the past. But I think the root cause of this is that we have so many trees, and we're used to them falling on lines.
And we love our trees.
Yeah,
we love them. Let's
exactly.
Cut them all down.
No, it's true. But the fact is that you know, in a place that's perhaps a little less tree-covered, you won't be so used to these kinds of effects. So yeah, that's a part of being in New Hampshire.
All right. Well, we'll take your calls after a short break and hear from another one of the state's major utilities. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Pax World Mutual Funds, a leader in sustainable investing, integrating environmental, social, and governance factors into investment analysis and decision-making. PaxWorld.com for tomorrow. And from AARP presenting You've Earned a Say, a community discussion on Medicare and Social Security, inviting Granite Status to join the conversation. Details at aarp.org/NH. 940, this is NHPR.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Discovering new ideas often means asking the right question.
What was the question?
That's the best question you can pull out of that stack.
How can I help you?
Word of mouth. Unexpected radio for the inquiring mind. Monday through Thursday at noon and again at 9 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a day after Superstorm Sandy hit, we're assessing the impact on the Granite State and around the region. Let's hear from you. How did the storm affect you or your town? What are you hearing from friends and relatives, perhaps in other areas where the weather, as we just heard, was much, much worse? Give us a call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. Sam Evans Brown is with us for the hour. He's been tracking storm coverage for us here at New Hampshire Public Radio. And Sam, one more voice I want to bring into our conversation. Alec O'Meara is with us, media contact for Unitil, which serves 75,000 customers in the Concord and Southern Seacoast areas. And Alec, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, and again, as we did with public service in New Hampshire, the numbers first, if you could, Mike. How many people among your customers at one point were without power, and where are we at now?
Sure. We hit peak right around 11 p.m. last night. We were right up around 41, 42,000 customers system-wide. We also have about, aside from the 75,000 you mentioned, we have another about 25 to 28,000 customers in north central Massachusetts. So we were at 41, 42 with the vast majority of those on the coast. Right now we made good progress overnight. I think we're right around the 24 to 25,000 customers out now. We had some nice pickups in the Concord, New Hampshire area. We're still seeing about 19,000 folks out on the seacoast, and that's going to be where we're going to have an awful lot of attention today.
Well, and we've learned from past storms, right, Alec, that you tend to restore the densely populated areas first, because with one fix, you can bring, 30,000 people back online. The people who live further out sometimes have to wait a little bit.
That's exactly right. The way I describe it is you think of power restoration as rebuilding a tree. And if you're rebuilding a tree, the place you need to start with that tree is on the trunk of the tree. So you try and get your main arteries back on, and that's going to bring on the biggest chunks of people right away. And then as you work further out in your infrastructure, you're getting to smaller and smaller branches and smaller limbs. And there may be a higher number of issues out at that level, but each issue is bringing on a smaller and smaller number of customers.
Sure.
So that's how we have to go about it. There's things that we can see right away that we're going to be able to work on. We're going to try and get those done. And we're also in the process of our damage assessment phase, so we can get a clear picture of the damage we're seeing out there, so we can give people good information as far as how long it's going to take to get everybody back on.
Well, and one last question for you, Alec. What changes has your company made in terms of how it prepares itself and its customers for these more frequent major weather events?
Boy, well, I mean, we take a look at that after every single storm, and I think after every one of these 100-year events we've had over the last 5 years, I think we've had 500-year events at this point.
Yeah, sounds kind of silly almost to call them 100-year events, but go ahead.
They're annual 100-year events, that's right.
Right.
We take a look at that, and we add something different every time. After Irene, we rescheduled and we kind of reordered how we have conference calls with our first responders to keep them informed. We've added the frequency of those. We started them earlier, so we're all on the same page. After the windstorm in 2009, we added a Twitter feed. That helped us keep in better contact with our customers. It helped keep media better informed. Between Snowtober and this one, we launched an outage map that gives real-time information to our customers. It lets people sort of keep track of progress, really gives them a window as to what's going on in our electric infrastructure. And I'm sure that after this storm, we'll find something else that we can tweak. I think that you have to have a philosophy after each of these storms, not that you have your plan in place, but what can you do better the next time around? And then that's really how we approach it.
And Alec, I'd like to just ask you a quick question. Has there been any talk about where the cost curves meet, perhaps in burying some of these bigger lines in denser areas versus having to put them up for storm after they fall down?
I believe there is a good study that was done by the state recently on that. I suggest you guys try and get a hold of that. I don't know what the numbers off the top of my head are, but I do know that by and large, because of our state, because we have a lot of ledge in the ground, it is cost prohibitive, really, to go about burying all the lines. I think that the study, something along the lines of hundreds of dollars a month, people's bills would go up to do something like that. It isn't really something that makes sense for the state of New Hampshire. It's something that gets brought up an awful lot on these types of events. Another thing that is something people don't necessarily think about when it comes to burying the lines, when the lines are above ground, it's easier to find the issue and it's easier to get that issue fixed. Things still break when they're underground, and if you have an underground issue, it can take that much longer to find it. Usually an issue that might be a couple-hour fix above ground can be an all-day affair if it's underground.
All right, Alec, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, glad to help.
Alec O'Meara, media contact for Unitil, which serves about 75,000 customers in the Concord and Southern Seacoast areas. Our number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Sam, let's take a call. This is Carolyn in Gilmanton. Hi, Carolyn. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to put a little perspective on the storm. I'm old enough to remember the hurricane of 1938, for which there was no warning to anybody. And also a whole series that happened in the 1950s. I was in college when the eye of the hurricane came over the college and put the steeple into the auditorium.
Wow.
And I can remember one also in a little later in the 50s that came right over the hill I'm living on with the eye. And we were dumb enough not to realize what it was at the time. But you know, these storms happen. This is not the end of the world. And we, the whole generation has grown up not ever having experienced a hurricane coming here. But sooner or later, we'll get one.
Well, we've gotten one in the past couple of years, don't you think, Carolyn?
Nothing like the ones in the 50s.
Really? Okay, yeah. Interesting. And real interesting to hear her talk about also that we didn't know it was coming back then.
That is true. And I think that what we perhaps could call hype, folks who are public officials, safety officials, would say that that's information, and that getting that information out can actually help save lives, because if you know it's coming, you can take steps to be prepared. Having a little bit of perspective, I think, is important. As she said, these things do happen, and big storms, yes, constantly come through. Last year, we lost 315,000 folks didn't have power when the snowstorm came through, and it was only 200,000 this time. So it is important to keep that perspective. This was a big event, certainly not the biggest, though.
Well, and the warnings to stay off the roads and close schools and so forth, Sam, you know, when the storm doesn't end up being as big, people think, well, what the heck was that all about? On the other hand, maybe fatalities and injuries are going down because people are staying home.
Yeah, I think certainly that is the case that public officials would make.
Let's take another call. Carolyn, thanks for that one. Great to get your perspective on the hurricane of 38. And Steve's waiting in Concord. Hi, Steve. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
I sure can. Yep.
Okay. I'm calling. I don't know if your Unitil person is still with you, but I'm calling about something that's really time to be straightened out and fixed. We've been paying, you and I and everybody who pays an electric bill, we've been paying for this ineptness on the part of the engineers that work for the power company for many years, and that is that they don't seem to know how to protect the transformer from exploding when a tree limb comes down on a high-voltage line. And if we can send a man to the moon, we can certainly devise an appropriate circuit breaker or fuse or whatever it would take so that we don't have to have these very, very expensive transformers exploding all over the place as we had happen near the prison in Concord last night.
So there was an explosion in Concord last night, Steve?
Yeah, there was. I had several people report it to me.
Wow. And as we heard from Keith Shields, there were lots of explosions when transformers blew up in the New York, New Jersey area. Sam, have you heard a lot of these dramatic stories like we heard from Keith here in New Hampshire? Steve's telling us about one for sure.
Certainly lots of stories. I know down in Nashua there was a line that was actually arcing into a house. It caused a large fire down there. So this is a problem. I think that if we don't have our utility representatives on the line with us anymore, but I think that if we were to hear from them, they might tell us that it's very expensive to institute put a solution in place is perhaps what they would say. There are lots of transformers out there that would be a lot of infrastructure to replace.
Although, Sam, Steve, thank you for the call, because I was not aware of that. So good to hear from you. Yes, our Unitil person is not with us now. With us on the phone, another caller from Concord is Regina. Hi, Regina. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Actually, I live in Stratford, but I'm at work now in Concord. And
okay.
I just wanted to give my experience this morning. And I woke up with, we have a generator, but I had no phone. I have a cable phone, no internet. And just electricity from the generator. And contrary to what some of the folks are saying from PSNH, even with the smartphone, I could access no information. And I went 9 days without power during the ice storm. I live in the neighborhood of 100 homes. Is, you know, we kept hearing that they were going from the big streets to the little streets to the neighborhoods. But, you know, a neighborhood with 100 homes, I don't think we should have been without power 9 days. And, you know, just the lack of information this morning made me feel like, have we really learned anything?
Wow. So you were out without power for 9 days during the ice storm of 08.
Yeah. Part of our neighborhood was restored on day 7, and our street was another 2 days. And, you know, this morning I heard there's road closures and no toll-free number to call. I could have driven with my cell phone and gotten service just to make sure I should come into Concord today. But I guess I just feel like I think the state does do a better job, but as far as the emergency centers. But the communication is still a huge issue. And to assume that people with a smartphone can access the Internet, you know, I couldn't. I was texting people I knew in other parts of the state to find out information.
Yeah, and did those texts succeed, Regina?
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
You know, if you stand in a certain corner, it's like the old days when you had tinfoil on the TV antenna, kind of like that, with cell service in parts of New Hampshire still.
Yeah, Regina, thanks a lot for calling in, and good luck getting power restored and so forth. Communication, Sam, certainly we heard from our utility folks earlier and from Jin Van Dongen that the state, private companies are, you know, doing their darndest to communicate. But she's right. I had some trouble getting some information last night, too.
No, yeah, absolutely. I mean, communication is going to be imperfect in a situation like this, especially in a state like New Hampshire that, you know, even regular cell phone coverage is spotty, not to mention 3G coverage that you would need to access the Internet. So, you know, and that has actually become a political issue this season, is talking about expanding our communications infrastructure so we don't have these dead zones. You know, I have my extended family lives in Northwood, and I can tell you she's right. If I wanted to get onto PSNH's website around there, I wouldn't be able to do it.
Thanks for the call, Regina. And again, good luck. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's an interesting email, Sam, from Sarah, who says, my boyfriend and two cats and I had to evacuate Brooklyn, New York to Bristol, New Hampshire, where our family has a lake house. We had flickering lights here and felt the gusting winds. We have heard there is flooding all around our apartment. Again, she's in Brooklyn. Keep our fingers crossed today that we can return to a dry home with power. Sarah says, by the way, thank you, NHPR. She's kept us on all weekend. Sarah, thanks for the email. Lots of connections between New Hampshire and the New York, New Jersey area, Sam. Just about everybody's got somebody down there that they're worried about.
Well, yes, indeed. I mean, it's such a huge population center. It's easy to find a connection there. And certainly, if I were having to evacuate from Brooklyn, Bristol's a nice place to go.
What do you think, Sam? What are you going to be watching today in terms of cleanup, in terms of what to look out for here in the Granite State? I mean, it's, as we've been hearing, it looks better, but be careful.
No, certainly outages are sort of the first thing that we're tracking. As folks have said, they sort of seem to have peaked around 11 o'clock last night and then dropped a little bit. But now they're sort of trebling. I know when I first came in this morning at about 6:30, we were down to 174,000 people without power. And then it bumped up a bit again up to 175,000. So, you know, it seems like the easy fixes have been done, and they're really going to have to start getting into the harder ones now. And but then also, you know, we're looking at road closures. But I think that really the worst is behind us, and it's just going to be, you know, following the cleanup, seeing how it goes.
Yeah, and there's been some assessment of the impact on the political climate here in New Hampshire. Certainly, Sam, we can't sit here and say this favors Obama, this favors Mitt Romney, but lots of political activity did get canceled.
No, absolutely. We had a visit. We had visits by surrogates on both sides. Ann Romney had to cancel. Chris Christie, all sorts of folks who had planned visits had to cancel them. And I think you know, pundits have certainly taken this one and run with it on both sides. Folks have said that, you know, oh, this is Obama's to lose, and other folks have said, oh, this really favors Obama. He looks presidential. But really, you know, there's nothing that can be said that is definitive in any way. And we'll just have to see where things head.
Beyond the cancellations, obviously.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah. No, it really has just put things on hold in the Granite State.
What do you think we've learned from this one, Sam? I think it was Alec from Unitil who said earlier, probably, you know, we keep learning storm by storm by storm. I think Alec said, after this storm, we'll learn something else. Again, it's still new, but what do you think? What are we learning from this particular event?
Well, you know, I think that Governor Lynch said it best, that it really is, you know, it can't hurt to be a little overprepared on these things. Sure, you have to call up folks and pay them extra salaries, but the opposite being true is far worse. If you're not ready and something that's genuinely bad does happen, I think that is a far worse scenario than having a couple hundred National Guardsmen standing around filling sandbags that they then empty afterward.
Yeah, so better safe than sorry, as
exactly.
The old saying goes. Well, Sam, I know you've got a lot to do, so I appreciate you joining us today, and keep up the coverage.
Anytime.
That's Sam Evans-Brown, again, NHPR reporter, who has been working on our storm coverage here at New Hampshire Public Radio. By the way, if you're interested in the latest from the New York and New Jersey area where we've heard it is so much worse, here's the latest that we've gotten from the New York Times. Power remains out for roughly 6 million people, including a large swath of Manhattan. The storm was the most destructive in the 108-year history of New York's subway system. This is according to the chairman of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority. He released a statement early this morning. Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey called the damage to his state incalculable and said the Jersey Shore has been devastated. As he spoke, rescue teams were rushing to the aid of those stranded in Atlantic City and also in Bergen County, where the governor said tidal waters had overwhelmed a protective natural berm. At least 11 deaths, including 7 in the New York region, were tied to the storm. Toppled trees sparked fires in several areas, state authorities said, and falling limbs became deadly bludgeons in 3 of the New York deaths and 2 in Morris County, New Jersey. So there is the latest that we have from New York and New Jersey, where, as we've heard, the storm was much, much worse. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Samantha Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Knoy.